I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, May 5th, 2026, and the time is 9 a.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members present today, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Myers, Senator Dunbar, Senator Klayman, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, and I'm Senator Giesel. We have a quorum to conduct business, and thank you to Heather and Kyla who are helping us out today. Today, the subject of our meeting is the Supporting a Gasline for Alaskans Act, otherwise known as Senate Bill 280. This is our 24th hearing of this bill in the last 2 months since the governor submitted it to us on March 20th. Today, invited to speak to the committee is our members of the Alaska Gasoline Development Corporation, as well as Glenn Farn. And I would, I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Adam Prestige here today. I see Frank Richards is on the phone or on the phone. We also have David Herbert, Commercial Analyst, Tax Division, Department of Revenue, and Owen Stevens, Commercial Analyst, Department of Revenue, both in the Tax Division. Mark Begich has also signed on. So I know he's catching his breath, so how about if we start with Frank Richards and let Mr. Prestige catch his breath? I know he just arrived. Mr. Richards, welcome to the meeting. We welcome your comments about the latest committee substitute for the Supporting a Gasline for Alaskans Act.
Madam Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Frank Richards. I'm the president of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. And I apologize, Madam Chair. We have been looking at the Senate version or the committee substitute version H and still pouring through it to look at what the changes were to see what the impacts are. So I do not have any prepared remarks today specifically on version H, but we'll be happy to answer questions. And again, as Mr. Prestige comes forward, we'll be able to talk through, again, the roles and responsibilities between HEDC and Glenn Farm as the project developer.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. All right, I guess he's thrown it to you, Mr. Prestige. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I realize you just arrived a few minutes ago.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here and appreciate all of the work and time and attention from this committee.
Do you have any feedback to offer us concerning the latest committee substitute or other updates related to the project itself?
A little bit in the same boat as Frank. I flew up to return to Juneau overnight last night, and so kind of digesting the committee substitute with a pretty short window of time, which is fine. I understand that's how things work. So happy to answer questions about it. I think in terms of the overall update on the project, we see a lot of progress being made, both with the Senate bill and the companion, the version of the bill in the House. I think there's a good dialogue and a good, a lot of good reflections on how these two bills can be shaped to advance the project. And I just want to reiterate that the perspective that we have when we talk about changes to this bill and objectives of this bill, the primary objectives that we have continue to be, how can we deliver the lowest cost gas to Alaskans? How can we do so as quickly as possible? Obviously, safety is always the highest priority in how we operate, but here, related to this bill, lowest cost and certainty to bring the project online are our priorities.
Well, thank you for that. We are actually seeking from you some concrete numbers. Right now, the bill proposes an AVT, alternative tax value, of 15 cents per MCF on the gas treatment plant, $0.15 per MCF on the pipeline and 25% on, or 25 cents on the LNG plant. If these numbers, we're interested in your feedback, concrete feedback on that. We also, of course, have made a few policy changes related to AGDC and the project itself as far as transparency. We removed, of course, the publication of a lot of information and things like that. But we're still requesting an Open Meetings Act implementation and other policies. We really are looking for concrete feedback from you.
Okay, absolutely.
The other thing I would say to both you and Mr. Richards, the bill was sent to you as soon as it reached our hands. The governor yesterday made it pretty clear that he expects this to be a final product by May 20th. So this committee is meeting every day on this bill. I realize it may seem like a short time frame to you to get the bill 2 days ago or a day ago, but for us it's the same deal. So,
well, and Madam Chair, sorry to interrupt. Far be it from me to have any complaints about how quickly things are moving. I understand that's the nature, and I'm often on the other side of this conversation. On the tariff itself, if you tally up the stack tariffs that are presented in this bill, 15 cents, 15 cents, and 25 cents, you end up with a 55 cent per MCF tax. I would describe that as very burdensome for the project and potentially prohibitively so in terms of having a phase one project go forward on any of the timelines that we've discussed in terms of having, you know, an FID in the near future. So I would characterize that tax at that level as something that would send, that would require some real reconsideration at the drawing board of how the project is structured and taken forward. And I don't know what the outcome of that kind of re-examination of the project would be.
Well, thank you for that. Just for clarification, phase one is a pipeline, and recently you've also added the gas treatment facility to that phase one approach. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, just a clarification. When we say the gas treatment facility, what that is historically always referred to is a 3.9 BCF a day gas treatment facility to bring North Slope gas down to the specifications required for LNG. There's a much, much smaller, probably less than a tenth of the size gas treatment facility required for phase one to bring North Slope gas down to utility grade gas, but the significantly smaller than the gas treatment facility.
Understood. Thank you for that clarification. But when you say 55 cents an MCF is very burdensome for phase one is actually 15 cents for the pipeline and 15 cents for a gas treatment facility.
Thank you for that clarification. The way to look at that is 15 cents on phase one would still be a doubling of the tax on the project. The remaining tax on phase two obviously puts phase two at jeopardy, and what you end up putting at risk then is the probability of, or how quickly could we bring the remaining portions of the project online that would have the effect of dramatically lowering the cost of gas on the project. The cost of gas delivered on the pipeline.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator Wilkowski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Trying to understand your numbers, because normally the way I'll just tell you in my experience, when we do projects like this, at least for me, having served on this committee for almost 20 years, going through AGEA, going through ACES, going through SB 21. I've had commissioners, deputy commissioners, tax directors in my office every day when we do projects. You know how many visits I've had on this one? By commissioners, deputy commissioners? Zero. Not a single one. And I don't know if other committee members have had the same. So from my perspective, when you say 55 cents is burdensome, let's talk numbers. I mean, this is all about the numbers from my perspective. You can sit there, and I wouldn't expect you to say anything less, because I've seen producers, I've seen people who are impacted by tax decisions. They always say that. I mean, it's your job. Your job is to get the maximum value for your company, and our job is to get the maximum value for the people of Alaska. You understand that, right? We're not trying to kill the project. We're just trying to do our constitutional obligation. You understand that, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so, to that end, I want to try to break down, because you say 55 cents is overly burdensome, and the governor said, you know, some things are overly burdensome, and you know, it's just sort of analogous that we're being asked to decide, you know, a decision that will impact generations of Alaskans within a few weeks, and the governor couldn't implement an elections bill within 26 weeks, just to put things in, you know, into perspective here. That said, what's the cost of your project?
The cost of the project hasn't been, I should revise that. The most recent most recent published cost of the project has been approximately $46 billion. We conducted a FEED process to reestimate the cost of the pipeline itself. That was completed in December, and we have not released the results, the economic results of that FEED process publicly.
Okay. So, I'm not sure if I can follow.
Yes, follow up.
Do you understand the challenge that we're working with? If you're saying 55 cents is too much, and you want 6 cents, I guess, and the governor said yesterday, well, maybe 10 cents. I don't know. He nearly doubled his. He negotiated against himself and went up to 10, I guess, yesterday in his press conference. In order for us to come up with the number that we think is fair to the people of Alaska and to you, we need the numbers. Like, I can't make – I'm not going to vote on a bill without numbers. I'm not going to vote on a bill that's going to take away $1 billion in potential future taxes and revenue from communities across Alaska without having firm numbers. And so we can wait all summer if we have to. But if you're not going to give us the numbers, or we're not going to get firm numbers, or if the Department of Revenue is not going to give us firm numbers, from my perspective, this bill should not go to the floor, because I am not going to commit generations. Me personally, I don't want to commit generations of Alaskans to billions of dollars in tax breaks without firm numbers. You wouldn't commit that. You're working the numbers. I'm sure you've probably got a whole team of tax analysts and tax accountants and attorneys who are working this, scrutinizing every single penny. And you can understand how we would want to do the same, right?
I can. Yes. Okay.
So can we get some? And I know it puts you in an awkward position to do this, but we got to get the numbers from somewhere. And we all know it's not $46 billion. I think we all know that. It's not $46 billion, is it?
What we've said is that the DOR's numbers are a good representation of the construction cost of the project. The assumptions that have gone into those numbers and those estimates are good assumptions. And the escalation that they've applied is the same escalation that we've applied in our estimates. And so when it comes to estimating kind of the impact of this tax, the DOR numbers are generally representative of the quantum of kind of the tax adjustment that we're seeking.
Follow up.
So you're saying that we should rely on $46 billion to come to calculating what?
I'm saying that
numbers are.
I'm saying that it's not an unreasonable starting, an unreasonable place to calculate that from. Yes.
Follow up, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. The first is we have spoken. We spoke yesterday, and we spoke in the past about roads and road upgrades. And our understanding, and I think you have said this publicly before too, you, Glenn Foran and AGDC, that the project plans to pay for a number of upgrades and repairs to roads. Can you, or maybe Mr. Richards might be the more appropriate person, explain how exactly that would work and which roads we're talking about. Are you talking about just the access roads that are sort of immediately adjacent to the project, or are we talking about things that are a little more far afield, like the Richardson Highway and the Dalton Highway? And if so, you know, there are a variety of federal requirements when you do those kind of that kind of road maintenance. Would you be doing it on your own? Would you be doing it as a contractor under the aegis of the Department of Transportation? How would you actually accomplish those upgrades if those are the roads you're going to do, or is it just access roads immediately adjacent to the project?
So thank you, Senator Dunbar. We have a commitment and an expectation that the project will repair and maintain any damage or any use to roads that are caused by the construction activities of the project. And the first way that that's handled is our construction contractors include that in the price that they bid for their work of construction on the project. Those bids include crews and time and labor for actual road work, road repairs. We also anticipate entering into a highway use agreement with the Department of Transportation that will help basically create the details for some of the things you're asking about. And so that's the general premise of the project, is that we are planning to and have already counted financially for repair of all road use. But maybe with that, I'll ask if I can hear from Frank Richards on that point as well.
Mr. Richards?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. It took them a while to unmute me. But again, for the record, Frank Richards, AEDC, through the chair, Senator Dunbar. Again, what Adam described is a highway use agreement that has been the concept from the initiation of the project with DOT. And this is really around not only the permits required to be able to gain access to the highways and driveway permits and oversized and overweight permits, but it's also around the operational and maintenance needs during the project itself. So you asked specifically about the individual highways, and so you can envision that this project will run from the North Slope through to South Central Alaska. So it will include the Dalton Highway, it will include portions of the Elliott, it will include the Parks Highway, and even portions of the Seward Highway for any materials that will be hauled from directly from Seward. But also, it will include the Kenai Spur Highway. And this is an area where the Kenai Spur Highway currently runs directly through the LNG plant location. So it will need to be relocated. So work that we had done previously came up with an alternative design and ultimately cost estimate to be able to accomplish that. And that will be borne essentially by the project to be able to design and construct that highway to national highway system standards so that DOT would be eligible to receive that road once it's in its final form and add it to its inventory of highway responsibilities. So that is, again, one of the at the far end of what is needed to make this project work with DOT in a cooperative manner to be able to address the transportation impacts during construction, but also long-term in terms of what will be necessary for the project to work with DOT to make sure that ongoing operations and ongoing construction projects are sequenced and timed in such a way that it's not as directly impactful to the project, because it's going to be very, very hard for a pipeline construction project to be able to be working directly through highway construction zones that will impact the cadence and ultimately the cost of that project. So the cooperation from the department has been exceptional. The communications are good. As you know, the commissioner of the Department of Transportation sits on as a member of the AEDC board. So we are actively engaged with the commissioner and his team to make sure that the DOT is highly aware of the actions and the planning efforts necessary to execute this transformational project.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned that there is a cost estimate you have for the portion in the Kenai Could you share with us what that cost estimate is, and then your other cost estimate, the total amount you expect the project to spend, both through the highway use agreement, but then through any other necessary expenditure of funds? And then also, I'll say, the governor proposed a surcharge to on oil to pay for upgrades and more repairs to the Dalton Highway. We have now included the governor's proposal in this bill. Do you feel that a repair fund like that to the Dalton Highway would assist the project in the needed upgrades? Mr. Richards.
Answer that directed to me?
Yes,
Mr. Richards.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Dunbar, through the chair, again, the work that AGDC undertook for the design of the Kenai Spur Highway was when the project was given to us by the producers, where they provided 75% ownership rights in the Alaska LNG project to AGDC. They gave us then the responsibility for establishing what was going to be the Kenai Spur Highway relocation. So it was affectionately at that time called a spaghetti map, and then residents of the communities of Kenai and Kiski were very upset because there was no determination on what was going to be the preferred relocation route. So we undertook essentially working with a local Alaskan road highway design firm to be able to come up with the alternatives, and ultimately landed on the relocation that goes essentially directly around the LNG plant site. That at that time, we asked them to provide us with a class 3 cost estimate, and was in the range of about $40 million to relocate the Kenai Spur Highway around the LNG site. And that was going to be constructed under a design build concept. That is something that we included in our package of information when Glen Farm became the project lead. And so that now falls within the working responsibilities of Glen Farm's engineering, procurement, and construction contractors to be able to move forward with that effort. And I think that is still being discussed, because, again, the main focus of recent times has been around developing the pipeline in phase one and updating the cost estimate to accomplish that. In regards to the overall maintenance and operations cost that it will take to be able to accomplish this, I think that there's an ongoing discussion now with the Department of Transportation, and specifically looking at the maintenance hours that they are currently staffed for, specifically, let's say, on the Dalton Highway. And if they're only staffed for 12 hours a day, but likely will need 24-hour days operations or maintenance or avalanche control, then we're going to need to be able to put a cost to that and then identify the best way to be able to accomplish that. DOT, as you know, has challenges in hiring of operators for their ranks, specifically those in those camp locations on the Dalton Highway. So it'll be an opportunity to be able to look for ways to best resource that through either DOT direct hires or through contracting efforts, as Adam described with the pipeline contractors.
Follow-ups.
In regards to the Dalton Highway, if I so continue, ma'am?
Yes, please. Please continue.
All right. In regards to the Dalton Highway, again, in my former life as a DOT representative, the Dalton was one of our primary focuses to be able to have it in as good a condition as possible. And in the 2010s and early 2010s, we put forward a significant amount of money that was appropriated by the legislature to help improve the Dalton Highway and resurface it, and as well as to improve the maintenance on it. And I understand that through the challenges of the budget, that has not kept up. So the opportunity to be able to have a funding source necessary to be able to assure that the maintenance and operations teams along the Dalton Highway have sufficient funds will be fabulous, because that is really the lifeline for Alaska and the oil fields that provide us with the revenues that provide us, you know, significant tax and royalty revenues, but also inputs into to our permanent fund. So having it in the best shape as possible is very beneficial for oil and gas development, the production of oil and gas, and ultimately the operation of the Alaska LNG project.
Brief follow, Madam Chair.
Follow up, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Richards. That was a very good and detailed answer. I just want a little more specificity on the. You talked about the $40 million for Kenai. I understand that the overall maintenance operation costs are sort of currently being discussed with DOT, but could you give us a rough order of magnitude? Are we talking tens of millions of dollars? Are we talking hundreds of millions of dollars? Could you provide us with that?
Through the chair, Representative Dunbar, I don't have that number right off the top of my head, but realizing that the DOT's maintenance and operation budget, if I remember correctly, is less than $100 million statewide, and that's for all facilities, highways, airports, buildings, et cetera. So in regards to the highway operations needed to keep the roads in operational good condition during construction, it will be significantly less than that.
So significantly less than $100 million. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question. It's regarding the H version of the bill. In Section 9 of the bill, there was an addition about the Administrative Procedures Act, and specifically it talks about will you be able to apply competitive bidding principles and provide vendors in state or to provide for vendors in state. And so they have the 5% rule for in-state Alaska bidders. And I know that you said that at a prior meeting that you've already got your EPC contractor. So I'm curious, will you be able to, under that EPC contractor, be able to reflect your competitive bidding principles and like a Alaska veterans preferences, those types of things.
Mr. Prestige?
Yes. Senator Kawasaki, thank you for that question. Just to reiterate, one of our core principles for Glenfarne, for 8-Star in pursuing this project in Alaska, is to prioritize working with Alaska-based companies, Alaska Native corporations, and hiring Alaskans for this project. And that's a foundation that goes to the Alaska Advantage principles in the joint venture agreement between Glenfarne and AGDC, which AGDC has presented on before. And so it goes back to that very foundation. In reinforcing that, and I guess backing up that commitment, we have done dozens and dozens and dozens of meetings with Alaskan contractors. We put on a contractor summit and had over 120 Alaskan contracting firms hear about the project. That was back in October. We conducted bidding processes on about 10 different scopes of work on the pipeline, and had many Alaskan contractors involved in that. We've appointed groups of primary pipeline construction firms for the main spreads of the pipeline. We've in those appointments, we've included several or multiple Alaska Native corporations to potentially work with those main pipeline construction firms. In addition, many of the additional scopes of work, such as early works, logistics, and many others, will include Alaska corporations or Alaska contractors. So that's very important to us. On the details, you'll have to pardon me, Senator Kawasaki. I'd like to get a little bit more familiar with the exact details of how the language is written in version H. However, just on a principled basis, we're committed to do that. At the same time, our principles of delivering gas at a low cost to Alaskans is an important counterbalance. So as with anything, there are two sides to the equation. So we wouldn't want to say that we will hire Alaskan firms or hire Alaskans at all costs, because eventually that could become prohibitive. And so we want to find the right balance, and that's what we're endeavoring to do.
Follow-up, Senator Kosaki?
No, I guess we'll hear a little bit more. And again, it's Section 9 of the new bill, Version H.
Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Preston, you describe that one of the components of the current version of Senate Bill 280, the three-tier tariff, and your words, I believe, were that it was too burdensome on the project. So let me ask, if we pass Senate Bill 280 in its current form with these three tiers of tariffs at 55 cents, does that mean Glen Farm walks away from the project, or where are you if this bill is what we pass?
Senator Klayman, that's a challenging question to answer, because I can't foresee exactly what the outcome would be. I know that we would have to take into account a tax that is significantly higher than, frankly, what we anticipated on this project when we came into it, when we looked at assumptions and considered guidance from industry experts, from Wood Mackenzie, and in general comparisons to other similar projects in North America. And so, quite frankly, we would have to re-examine the entire project and come up with a plan on how to take it forward. And so I don't know what the time what timeline that would require or what the outcome would be.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman.
Well, follow-up question on that, particularly if this is the measure that the legislature passes and the governor signs, would it be fair to say that you might not start construction right away, but you might stay around and try to work a different package that was better for purpose of the project going forward?
Senator Klayman, I think that is one potential outcome.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman?
So let's take another scenario. I mean, we're in this 15-day window till the end of session. Another scenario is, let's say the legislature, they don't adopt Senate Bill 280, they don't adopt what they're working on in the House, they don't adopt what the governor proposed originally. We can't agree on anything, and what you have is the existing tax structure. I assume, well, is Glen Farm ready to go forward in that circumstance as well?
Senator Klayman, that also would require a careful reexamination of the project. When we viewed the governor's bill with the 6 cents per MCF day, per MCF on the pipeline, we viewed that as fair in terms of industry comparisons to other projects, probably a little bit higher than what some of our competing projects pay to export LNG out of Canada, but a number, a tax that would allow the project to go forward quickly and to go to FID as quickly this year. And so that's the assumption that underpins that timeline and the cost of gas, quite frankly, that we're negotiating with NSTAR and other utilities and buyers in Alaska. And so a significant change from that would like I said, require significant reexamination of how we take the project forward.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman.
So is it fair to say, at least from Glen Farm's perspective today, that the only structure that's under discussion going forward that Glen Farm is confident that they could go forward and get to FID as fast as possible is if we adopt the governor's bill just as written with no changes?
Senator Klayman, what I'll say to that is that this is a very challenging project. And it has been, as you're all very well aware, decades of different attempts to try and take that project forward. We came into this project a little more than a year ago, believing that there is a way to take the entire project forward, and particularly to solve the need for Alaskans by taking the pipeline itself forward first, which is a challenge, as anyone can look at it and realize, you know, how the limited capacity on a large pipeline that it will use. And so there is a window of kind of financial feasibility that is needed in order to make phase one work. I will say that in response to your question, is only the governor's bill, is that the only version that works? I'd say there are other things. The answer to that question I'd say is no, because there are other elements that we believe can be added and we have basically discussed and agreed to add. Some of those include additional community benefit agreements and arrangements, a community impact fund to compensate with cash for actual disruptions to communities from construction, Fairbanks spur line, which has been very significantly discussed, but we have agreed to incorporate that as, or we are supportive of incorporating that as part of the project with certain conditions around permitting and regulatory approvals. And then last, we've agreed also that we think it makes sense to have to allow municipalities to participate in the equity investment of the project alongside the state of Alaska's 25%, or within the state of Alaska's 25% equity option. So those are elements that I'd say are additional to the governor's bill that we would be supportive of, and that we think would still facilitate the project going forward successfully and quickly.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Just to clarify, you don't need us to pass legislation for permitting or anything else to build this gas line. This is just all about the bill from the governor, the bill that you're seeking from us is just economics. You don't need any other legislation to go forward on this. Is that right?
To my knowledge, Senator Wilkowski, there's nothing else needed.
Okay.
Follow-up, okay. Senator Wilkowski.
So just getting back to the numbers. So $46.2 billion project. The DOR has been assuming a debt to equity ratio of 70-30. Is that what you're assuming?
I think that's a good assumption. It's within, you know, plus or minus 5 or 10%.
Okay.
It will, and pardon me, Senator Wilkowski, some of these things are not final yet. And so while we're negotiating with banks and equity investors, numbers like that in particular can move and shift. And so I also want to be careful to not create an early expectation among the committee or the public. But I'd say that 70-30 is a traditional debt to equity ratio for a project like this.
Follow up.
And what is the cost estimates that you're using for the gas treatment plant, the gas line, and the LNG plant?
So as I've stated, we conducted the FEED on the pipeline, and so we have a updated Class 2 estimate on the cost. What we are relying on for the remainder of the project is the engineering that was performed prior to Glen Farne's participation in the project. It was conducted by very well-qualified engineering and construction firms, and then we essentially have escalated that with inflation.
So what are those numbers for gas treatment plant, and gas line, and an LNG plant?
Pardon me, Senator Wilkowski, I don't have those numbers in front of me to present right now, and I'd have to come back to you on that.
Would Senator Wilkowski, Frank Richards is on. If
sure.
Mr. Richards, can you articulate those numbers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Frank Richards, AGDC, and I believe the number that Senator Wilkowski is referring to is the inflated numbers from Department of Revenue. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski.
I'm just trying to figure out the economics of this project because I don't have the numbers that I believe I need. So I'm asking you what the cost of the gas treatment plant is, the gas line is, and the LNG plant, the three separate numbers, the cost estimates.
Understood, Senator Wilkowski, again, through the chair. Again, based on what AGDC had previously provided, and I think we have been upgraded by or inflated by the Department of Revenue, was around a $44 billion project, now estimated around $46 billion. So in round numbers, again, the gas treatment plant is between $10 to $11 billion. The pipeline itself is approximately $16 billion, so that's 27 billion, and then the liquefaction facility was a little bit north of $20 billion.
Follow up.
Thank you. That's great. Okay, and then what is the return on equity that you're estimating?
Is that for Mr. Richards again?
Chair, Senator Wilkowski. Sorry, Madam Chair, was that directed to me?
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
When I ask AGDC a question, are you answering on behalf of Glen Farne? Are you, like, should I ask that question separately? Will I get the same answer if I ask Glenn Farn is, if I ask AGDC, I guess I want to just clarify that.
Mr. Prestige, how would you answer that question?
The way I'd answer that question is that we're seeking industry standard infrastructure rates of return. They are very different from a lot of other industries. Project finance rates of return rely on being stable and low risk, and therefore they're relatively lower compared to a lot of other industries. If you'll pardon me, Senator Willekowski, I think I would ask that question be directed to some of the committee's advisors to provide examples of what industry standard rates of return for project finance infrastructure projects would be.
Yeah. Follow up?
Yeah, and I would do that, except the problem is we did ask our advisor to calculate some corporate income tax rates, and it showed that you had a 50% return on equity. Should I rely on that number?
No, that's extremely.
What's your return on equity that you're expecting?
Significantly lower.
What's your return on equity?
I can't say that to the committee right now.
Okay, well, Mr. Richards, can you answer that question?
Mr. Richards?
Through the chair, Senator Willekowski, again, what we provided in the testimony from both AGDC and from the Department of Revenue was based on a 10% IRR.
Follow up.
Okay, so you're saying that for this project, you're anticipating a 10% internal rate of return.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's what we have identified in the model that has been presented by the Department of Revenue.
Follow up.
And so how about return on equity?
Mr. Richards.
Senator Wilkowski, again, Madam Chair, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, when I referred to the 10% rate of return, that was the return on the equity.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. Just so I can understand who the consultants are working for here and who everybody's working for is, so we've got the state, who Department of Revenue, and then you've got AGDC and Glenn Farn. Is the state Department of Revenue working directly with Glenn Farn to coordinate the analysis, the numbers on this, or are they providing separate numbers?
And you're asking Mr. Richards?
Yeah, I'm asking Chair, Mr. Richards, yeah.
Okay. Mr. Richards?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, Department of Revenue has been working with AGDC essentially soon after our creation in developing the model that they've been presenting to the committee. This has been a model that has been in development now and modified over the last decade or so, and it's been peer reviewed by other outside consultants as well as in consultation, again, formally when our partners were with the producers. So the validation of the model has been set. The accuracy of the model is good. The inputs that Department of Revenue is using is coming from collaboration with AGDC.
Follow up.
Is AGDC or the State Department of Revenue sharing that model with Glenn Farn?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, again, the outputs the model have been shared with Glenn Farm and the public.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
So here's my concern. This is basically a negotiation, a public negotiation, and the state's trying to get as much as we can, and Glenn Farm's trying to get as much as they can. And do you identify that as being a conflict when our state DOR, who is tasked with following our constitutional obligation to get the maximum value for the resources, working with basically in this case, and I know we're aligned on a lot of things, but in this particular case, they're trying to get as much as they can, and we're trying to get as much as we can. And do you see any conflict there with the state Department of Revenue basically consulting with and advising and providing sharing data with our competitor basically?
Senator Wilkowski, may I step in? I want to clarify, I don't view this as a negotiation where Glenn Farn is trying to get the most that we can out of this. I think that would not be a successful way to try to take this project forward. Our objective is to have the lowest cost gas for Alaskans and have certainty on the project. If we were trying to make the most money we possibly could out of this. You'd see there are ways to do that, which would include having a higher cost of gas for Alaskans. That's not what we're trying to do. This needs to be a project that goes forward fairly. The RCA will review and approve our gas sales agreement, so there's a high degree of transparency there. There's also, just want to remind everyone, the State of Alaska Investment Option, which allows the State of Alaska at FID to have the option to buy into the equity alongside all of the other investors. And so there's an extremely high level of transparency and financial analysis that will occur at that point. And so, quite frankly, we're having a lot of these conversations anticipating that the State of Alaska will have financial advisors and a full review of all of the project's financials. And I'm going to be back in front of you at that point, I would imagine. And, I need to be able to have a transparent and genuine conversation at that point where you recognize we haven't come into this project looking to make as much money as we possibly can on the backs of Alaskan ratepayers, because that's not our objective.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
I appreciate your statements, and please don't take what I'm saying wrong in any way. But please understand that the Senate version G will generate roughly $600 million for Alaskan communities, and the version the governor's proposing will generate $74 million. And so we're talking a wide gulf here, and somebody's going to make that the difference there, that $526 million difference. And that money goes somewhere, and it goes to your internal rate of return or whoever ultimately buys the equity in this. It goes to their rate of return. And it's as simple as that. So it's not, I know you're not a charity. Are you organized as a charity, a nonprofit? I don't think you are. Are you?
No.
And it's you have a fiduciary duty to make as much money as you can for your investors. Is that right?
Yes. Well, okay. No, actually, I don't know if we have a fiduciary duty. We're a public corporation, but yeah.
Okay.
Senator Wilkowski, one more, and then I'm going to move on. So okay. A couple other senators are waiting.
Yep, I understand. What is the governor has said publicly multiple times that he expects the cost of gas to Alaskan consumers to be between $4.50 and $4.75. Is that are those accurate numbers?
Senator Wilkowski, I think the final cost, the final price of gas to be delivered under the full execution of the project, which includes LNG and 3.5 approximately BCF a day flowing of gas, those are still being finalized. But what I can tell you is, our contract with NSTAR does anticipate a price sold to NSTAR under a 30-year agreement if the entire project were built out, and that price is within a few cents higher than than the number you stated there.
Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So my understanding is that the conversations around the modeling of DOR have primarily been conducted by Mr. Begich. Is he online? Could he chime in on this?
Mr. Begich is online. Mr. Begich, welcome to the committee. Senator Myers has a question for you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And Senator, on various comments that were made, it goes to the crux of the question that Senator Wilkowski asked. The modeling, as described by Adam and Frank, have been done by the Department of Revenue. But let me make sure there's a clear understanding of how the ATV works. The alternative tax, ABT, the alternative volumetric tax, whatever you put on that is going to the consumers. And I want to clarify a point that was just said by Senator Wilkowski. If you lower the tax, it does not go to the return or the profit or anything of this project. It goes away. It is not charged to anyone. It just goes away. That is a pass-through operational cost. So if you raise it, you are raising it on two things. It goes to the consumer. It will go into the NSTAR rate, the TruGas rate, MEA rate. You pick it. They'll pay it. That's how that is done. It's an operational cost. Second, The higher you raise that, the less competitive we are when we get ready to export. Export is based on pennies on the dollar. Our competition is Canada right now. And they have figured this out and are moving rapidly to garner as much Asian business as they can in order to hold the market. On top of that, the issue that people are laying out, and I understand the concern, and I just want to make it very clear, this money that is difference between the 6 cents and the 55 cents that you all are proposing on the final project, that money, if you keep it at six, does not go, that difference does not go in the pockets of anybody except the residents of Alaska. They do not pay it. And it also creates a competitive nature for us when we deal with the export in the future. There seems to be confusion that every dime you give up here, every penny you give up, somehow A-Star profits more. That is not the case. That is not accurate. And I want to make sure that's clear. On the modeling, and I'll clarify what Frank is saying, and that is Frank represents AGDC. AGDC, under their confidentiality agreements between them and Glenfarne, are able to give certain data to Department of Revenue, which then they model. And then Revenue takes it to one more step. As you know, with the heat charts they have presented to you time and time again, shows you variations on cost of the product, meaning the gas off the slope, and the construction costs with various cost overrun models. No cost overruns up to several hundred percent. They give you that to give you the variance of what could happen under certain circumstances. On the cost issue, which I know keeps being brought up, there are variances, and you've heard Glenfarne, AGDC, A-Star say that they accept the Department of Revenue's numbers, recognizing they have done some inflation adjustments onto it. Where that lays in the future, as they've said here multiple times, specifically to specific questions by senators, that on cost overrun, they will protect the consumer on that with language. They're happy to do that. On several sections of the bill, maybe section 12 that lays out caps, that does not work. I understand what you're saying, that the governor said certain things, just like politicians may say certain things that may not be as firm and accurate because they're in the press conference or you all are in some event. What we're saying is the price at the end of the day of the product, if everything goes as we anticipate with export lowers the cost to consumer by increasing the volume and lowering the cost of the capital over the Alaska consumer. We are anticipating, based on the models, $5 to $6 in that range. But part of that is just pipe. It will be competitive. It may not be exactly the same as export or import that may be required. It will be within the range of acceptable levels. The difference is very clear. If you make a decision to delay the project, two things will happen for sure. The cost of the project will go up, guaranteed. Second, the conditions we're in and the competitive nature will change radically. And what I mean by that is Canada has figured out we are their competition. First, the market, control the market. We have an opportunity to do this. And the conditions that we're working in will change. So I get the questions and happy to whip through some of these with you, but the caps don't work. You're setting artificial numbers. And you may say, well, the governor said it. Okay, governor said it. Doesn't mean it's the market. We're talking a multi-billion dollar project that the state of Alaska residents will gain billions of dollars in savings over time if we get going. So I understand the questioning angles here, but we're here on the same goal. If anyone on the committee objects to building a pipeline, okay, we get it. But I don't think so. I think we're all on the same page. And so we're here to work with you. And again, construction cost is not a bearing on the price. The price is the ABT tax is to control the cost of the product to the Alaska consumer and to get us competitive in the world market on a project that has been kicked around, talked about, multiple versions for 40 to 50 years. So that's Sorry, Senator, I didn't mean to ramble on there, Madam Chair, but I'm listening to this discussion, and if you want to get to the point of what works, your price model per unit does not work. If we want to be competitive in the world market.
Thank you, Senator, or Mr. Begich. Back to Senator Myers. Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Begich, you've identified the Canadians as our primary competitor here, and I'm curious if you have numbers available as to what the Canadians are charging to East Asian customers for their gas.
Mr. Begich?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm going to turn to Frank. I know Matt has presented these in the past, and I think Adam can, but let me pause for a second if I can and then come back based on their answer, if I can, to Adam or Frank to give some very specifics if possible.
Mr. Richards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I do not have the price that LNG Canada is charging to its Asian customers. So I'll defer to Mr. Prestige.
Thank you. Mr. Prestige?
Senator Myers, what I'll say to that is we have some indications, or we do have information and understanding of where the general market is for gas coming out of Canada. It's not something that I feel comfortable representing to the committee on, because I'm not, that's my purview, is not as an industry analyst. I will say our view is that Alaska LNG exports can be competitive with that under the right conditions. And those conditions include the tax arrangement that we've put forward. I will note that we've heard from Gaffney Klein in multiple scenarios that the Canadian projects benefit from a lower tax arrangement than even what is proposed in the governor's bill. And so that's certainly something that I believe they use to their competitive advantage.
Okay. Senator Myers, we'll submit that question to Mr. Fulford and ask him for a prompt answer.
Appreciate it.
Did you have follow-up?
No, right now.
All right. The next person on my list is Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just note, British Columbia has a personal income tax that goes from a rate of 5.6% up to 20.5% for income over $265,000. With that funding, they can both give a subsidy to a pipeline project and pay for universal health care and a bunch of other things. And so, Senator Myers, if you want to work with me on that, I'm open to it. They are able to provide a variety of subsidies with their income tax money. But my question is for Mr. Begich as well, because I know he's online. And I guess this is also for you, Mr. Prestige. And so two questions. The first is we know that it's true. I mean, you said that if we increase the volumetric tax, that price will be passed on to consumers. But when the project is at full capacity, 95% of the gas will be exported. So I hope you're not, and I don't think you are suggesting that a volumetric tax as applied to the LNG portion or to export would be somehow borne by Alaskan consumers. I mean, 95% of it will go into the international market, and we hope it will be competitive. But I mean, that's certainly the case, right? And then the second question is, so Mr. Begich, you've made statements in the past, I believe you said they were taken out of context, but talking about maybe $53 billion or $57 billion for the all-in costs for the project. And I want to give you a chance to clarify that. And I also want to ask you, Mr. Prestige, if you've done the additional feed, as you said at the beginning, why not share those numbers with us? I mean, if they are a bit higher, that's a good argument for this tax cut. You know, I don't really understand the what competitive advantage you get by close holding the numbers for the cost of construction when it's such a massive project and the request is for such a large tax break. So, you know, there's a couple of questions, and if Mr. Begich, if you could answer some of those, I appreciate it.
Yes, Senator Dunbar, it might be helpful if you just did one at a time. Senator Begich, do you recall what Senator Dunbar's question was?
Madam Chair, Senator, I do. He had two questions for me, one on the price that I've stated, but also on how is the volumetric tax qualified on the three components of the project. So the pipeline for your first question, Senator, the again, this is Mark Bagage on behalf of the state governor's office as a contractor. The pipeline bears the cost. You're correct. What goes on the export is done to the export market. But again, when you add to the export market too many pennies, and I say that literally pennies, to the price of what goes on, that product that we sell in an open market that is not determined by what we think the price is, but by the market conditions, if you put that price too high, we're not selling the volume we need, which then has a direct impact to lowering the cost to the consumer. But you're correct on the tax. The tax is on the pipeline. The pipeline is for the consumers of Alaska. But where we get the biggest benefit is when we're exporting. And if we have that price on the export too high because we've added a tax that's beyond what the market can bear, and we end up having a higher cost to our consumers because we don't get the volume. I don't know if that answers that question for you, if you want to follow up on that before I go to the second one, but I'm happy to pause for a second, Senator.
No, that's fine. Thank you. I'm sorry. Could you go on to the second question, Senator Bagage?
Yes. Madam Chair and Senator, they mute me every time I finish my last word, so I apologize. I have to wait for someone to unmute me. To your second question, which was the number I've used in a presentation among a group of former legislators, many that you have served with and others have served with in a discussion, it was a hypothetical based on a 25% cost increase. And I did that to understand worst case scenario, in my view, and this is my view, not based on an analysis done by Department of Revenue or Glenn Farn or AGDC. I just took the AG, the number that you all are working on, added 25%. And why did I do that? Because they were curious, which was a very fair question, if the state bought into the project, what would be the equity position? What would be the maximum cost? And I was trying to give them a high number. Just so that it's not as high as they think. And what I mean by that is, let's just say we'll use the number that Frank just said on the pipeline, $16 billion. If you take that number, the assumption is, well, the state has to come with 25% of that. Incorrect. This was actually the discussion we had on that call. 16, it is not correct. You have to take out the debt, and then what's remaining is what is equity that then the state can buy into at 25% or up to 25%. I calculated just using a number to help them illustrate what these costs could be to the state if they decide to invest. And that's how I come to the number.
Did that answer your question, Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Madam Chair. But if I could ask a brief follow-up to Mr. Prestige.
Mr. Prestige?
On the – is it Prestige?
Not Prestige. Prestige.
Prestige. Okay. I apologize. Mr. Prestige, so if you have updated numbers on the cost, why not share them? I mean, if they are higher, that's a good argument for why we need to have a tax cut to adjust. So why not share them? I don't understand.
Senator Dunbar, I agree. First, I agree with what Mark Bagage is saying, describing the competitiveness of the LNG market. It really is a market where, you know, cents, nickels can make a difference between a successful project or not. And so there's a very narrow and intensely negotiated competitive window. That goes into the answer to your question of why not disclose that. First of all, again, when the state has its option to invest equity, those numbers will be crystal clear because the project will have FID'd and will be known, and those numbers will be final. So that you've got that to basically, you've got that to hold us, to some accountability, if you will. But more importantly, where the project is right now is in the final stages of negotiating many commercial elements to the project. And so those commercial elements include this: the cost of gas being sold into the pipeline, the cost of gas being sold out of the pipeline to domestic buyers, the cost or the price of LNG being sold to buyers globally, the price that contractors are bidding for all of the different scopes of work for constructing the project. Each of those is in, I'd say, late stage negotiation, but we're still closing those deals and disclosing our cost estimates and disclosing what we have on our side of the model puts the project at a competitive disadvantage in each of those negotiations. And I can tell you, I've lived it many times where I will sit there often on a call or in a meeting, and I will listen to the counterparty try to back calculate what they think the cost of the product is that we're selling using what they've seen as public information. And it creates a real challenge for being able to commercialize the project.
One last follow-up, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. One last follow-up.
Thank you. If we're going to understand, if we're going to get all the numbers after FID and we'll understand the cost, does it make sense for us to then pass some version of the governor's bill with a one-year expiration date? That is, we pass something, we see the actual numbers, and we come back next year and see if what we passed was the right thing.
Senator Dunbar, I understand the premise of the question. Again, it's a challenging project. There are so many moving parts. One of those moving parts is that we do need lenders to lend into the project and equity investors, and they need to know a certainty, or they have a predictability to the loan or the investment that they're making, where they can see the next 30 years with some certainty, and that's how we're going to pull together the many billions of dollars for this project. I will say, for what it's worth, and I know this is unsatisfactory for various reasons, but we've expressed a willingness to enter into NDAs. I understand that's not tenable for many of the committee members. We've expressed an openness to executive sessions to be able to provide this information under more confidentiality protection. So it really is that confidentiality protection that and preserving that competitive privacy, I guess, if you will, that is driving our concern here. And we're open to finding ways other than public committee hearings to discuss project costs.
Thank you. Thank you, Manager.
Mr. Prestige, for you to give us information in confidence, in confidential executive sessions, puts us at a real disadvantage, because now we have to craft a bill based on what you've told us privately, and yet we can't tell the public what those numbers are. It doesn't work very well. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. I want to get back to some comments that I heard from Mr. Begich, and that is that the cost just gets passed through, and they don't impact the internal rate of return. If that's the case, just go ahead and build the line. Because the numbers that without us doing anything, because the impacts are disproportional. What we've heard or what we know is that if this out of, especially if it's $57 billion, which I think we all know is probably where the number is, if not higher, the state and the communities will lose $1 billion per year in property taxes, and so the governor's plan would drop that down to $74 million, and the state share of that is $300 million roughly. And so that comes out to every man, woman, and child in the state of Alaska giving up, whether it's in a PFD or whether it's in education funding or snowplow operations, roughly $500 per Alaskan. In exchange for what we've heard from DOR is 43 cents, a 43 cent cut per MCF. And we've heard we got my office contacted NSTAR, and we found in communication with them that the average Anchorage consumer uses about 128 MCF per year. And so when you multiply 128 MCF by 43 cents, that comes out to $55 a year. The state of Alaska is asking us, or the governor is asking us, to give up $1 billion for our communities, for the state of Alaska, $300 million for the state roughly, for $55 in reduction in fuel prices. The average family of four, and that's per household, the average family of four is giving up $2,000 of state money, just state money, that's not even including local property tax money, to get $55 in cost savings. That's not a good deal. And so from my perspective, I feel perfectly comfortable going back to my constituents and saying, you know what, we'll take the gas instead of at $4.50, tack on 43 cents, so it'll be $4.90. That'll still be great. We'll still take that. But we're going to save $1 billion in property taxes. I think that's a good deal since it doesn't impact your internal rate of return. It doesn't just gets passed on. Go ahead and build the gas line. And I feel perfectly comfortable going back to my constituents and say, you know what, we'll pay 43 cents more, but you're going to get $500 per person more in value. And the communities will get a heck of a lot more than that. My question, Madam Chair, is the cost. So I want to break this down. So cost of gas, what are you estimating the cost of gas to be that you're able to purchase it off the North Slope?
Senator Wilkowski, I believe public cost estimates for gas off the North Slope have been in the range of $1.50 per MMCF.
Follow up.
Okay. And then what are you projecting the cost of the tariff in phase one for the gas line and the GTP plant?
Senator Wilkowski, that's not a number that I believe we've made public yet. That number would be made public once we have executed an agreement with NSTAR, and that agreement has been filed with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Okay. Follow up.
I'm just trying to understand the governor's $4.50 number price for gas. And so can I assume that it's less than $3?
Under the full execution plan, the full utilization of the project? In that range.
But that's not what the governor said. He didn't say in his piece that he put out that it was in phase two. He just said you're getting gas for $4.50, $4.75. He didn't delineate between phase two. Are you saying that the governor is wrong and that you don't get that in phase one? Is it higher than $4.50 or $4.75 in phase one?
Senator Wilkowski, I don't recall the governor's specific comments. I think the model we've designed is a model that delivers gas to Alaskans under a phase one pipeline. It gets the pipe built, and then once the LNG facility comes online and utilizes the full capacity of the pipeline, then the transport cost per unit on the pipeline goes down significantly.
Follow up.
So what is the cost to Alaskan consumers under phase one?
So, Senator Wilkowski, that will be submitted to the Regulatory Commission as soon as possible.
Follow up.
I'm wondering if Mr. Richards can give us a number. What is the cost estimate? We've heard from the governor. It's $4.50. He didn't delineate between phase one or phase two. What is the number to Alaskan consumers for phase one gas to the burner tip at the consumer's home?
Mr. Begich.
Madam Chair, to the Senator, first off, I think you've heard from Adam regarding the rate structure, which will be they're negotiating with NSTAR as we speak. That will be public information. The public will have all the time in the world to have that conversation. But to your specific question, Senator, okay, he didn't delineate. Okay, however you want to say that, it's not going to be $4.50 when the pipe is only the pipe. Does that help clarify that question?
Senator Wilkowski.
Just want to know what the number
that's
is.
That's your question. You're challenging the governor.
I just want to know what the phase one number is.
On the price.
The governor said $4.50. I just want to know what the number is. Is he right? Yeah, is he wrong? What's the number?
The number that you're quoting and restating from the information that you have from the governor at $4.50, I think that's what you said, that will not be the price that consumers will pay if it's only a pipeline. That's a fact. Today, consumers pay on the new contracts out of Cook Inlet $13 plus, and they're going up from there, as you've heard from the president of NSTAR. So if you're trying to say the governor wasn't forthright I'm not going to give any comment on that point. You disagree with them, you disagree with them. But the $4.50 is not for the phase one pipe only. So hopefully we can stop that battering back and forth, frankly, Madam Chair and the Senator, because that just is a useless conversation. If your question is, if your concern is, how will this project compare to import fuel and the comparison on price? If that is your question, I'm happy to answer. You have two choices. If you import, there's one thing that will surely happen. The state will get nothing in revenue stream. Two, the Alaskan consumer will be subject to foreign entities, a concern you stated in your S version you keep bringing up. So we are now subject to foreign natural gas. Third, we will not create jobs for Alaskans. Four, we were dependent on world stability, which is not really in the world these days, versus Alaskan gas, jobs for Alaskans, value for Alaskans. If the gas line completes the way we anticipate it with export, it will save consumers $1,450 per family in the South Central region per year. That's real money to consumers. And the last statement I'd make on this, will it be a little bit higher than import? Potentially. Potentially. But our risk is greater. The risk of depending on foreign oil or natural gas would be a significant mistake. And also, all the money you're talking about is irrelevant, because they will not collect it, because you will not have the pipe in your jurisdiction producing out of oil and gas. And lastly, to your concern, Madam Chair, to the Senator, the concern you have, just pass it on, $55. I don't know what your numbers come from. I'm not here to debate them. That's your political statement and your speech today. But I'm just telling you right now, every dollar you save to consumers, it's a dollar in your pocket in an economy that is struggling, in a state that has no direction in the sense of its economy right now, because energy is the bottom line. And all we've seen from cooking the gas, NSTAR and others, we've seen 20-30% increases. And we need to solve this problem. That is the issue. But if your issue is, did the governor make a statement not delineate between phase one, phase two? Okay, yes. But $450 is not what you will get if we just build a pipeline. But the pipeline is the riskier part of the project. Once you build the pipeline, import-export is our target. Why? Because that will lower the cost across the board. We will benefit from selling our natural resources, which is what our Constitution talks about. Take our resource, get the highest and best value, to foreign entities that will buy it from us, that we can lower the cost to consumers. That seems like a pretty good deal when we can sell it to someone else and lower our costs, and consumers in our state benefit.
Mr. Begich, you have, well, it's been stated here that AGDC and our Department of Revenue are collaborating. So the what are called heat charts, sensitivity matrices, which are submitted to us by our Department of Revenue, should reflect working with, well, it's not you, it's actually Mr. Richards and AGDC. And at $1.50 with the Senate Bill 280 that the governor introduced, and $1.50 at the wellhead price for natural gas, shows a break-even price of $4.43. But we know that NSTAR has infrastructure costs, and they tack on a little over $10, $10, $11. So it's unrealistic to even tell consumers that $5 gas is what they'll experience. It's going to be at least 15, if not more. Now, that's for the in-state. If we look at the LNG heat map, at $1.50, as the governor introduced it, it says $8.48. So that, I believe, is what it will cost after the whole thing is constructed, full construction. So the numbers don't add up. And when the governor says $5, it's deceiving to the public. So that's what we're trying to get to here. What is the actual cost that the public, what's the realistic cost for the public? Senator Willikowski, did you have follow-up?
I did. Yeah, thank you. Well, I will just say, you know, I know just on Cook Inlet Gas, I would remind the public that there is 19 trillion cubic feet of gas in Cook Inlet controlled 90% by an outside Texas billionaire that I have requested and the utilities have requested to Governor Dunleavy and his attorney general that he enforce their leases. And he previously enforced the consent decree before it expired. That was the real answer to how you get low-cost gas in Cook Inlet. You have a governor who did nothing and let a Texas billionaire control our Cook Inlet gas. That's predicament one. Predicament two was we had 400 to 500 megawatts of renewable power lined up and down the rail belt via tax credits from the federal government that that were yanked by the president of the United States. And our congressional delegation did nothing to stop that, by the way, nor did Governor Dunleavy, costing us 400 to 500 megawatts of power, renewable power, all up and down the rail belt that would have solved a lot of our gas problems. That said, we're basically the governor took a gun and pointed it at our heads and said, you're going to have to do this gas line project and pay exorbitant prices. That's why we are where we are. And so all I was asking, Mr. Begich, was the governor said $4.50. What is the phase one number? That's all I'm asking. I just wanted to know from you or from anybody what the phase one number was.
Senator Klayman?
Bilikowski,
asked at the burner tip. Just a simple question. Just give me the number. Tell the people of Alaska what the number is.
Mr. Prestige?
Senator Bilikowski, I think earlier in this session, you mentioned these numbers, and I have I've explained that in phase two, our contract with NSTAR anticipates the cost of gas lowering to a number that is not far off from that $4.50 range.
Okay, so
follow up, Senator Bilikowski.
So you're saying phase one, just so we're clear, the gas price for consumers in South Central will be $4.50.
Senator Bilikowski, no, that's roughly, not roughly. What I'm saying. I'm referring to phase two.
I'm asking about phase one.
With respect to phase two, with phase one, I think what's been stated here is that the cost of gas would be competitive against alternatives, including Cook Inlet gas, LNG imports, and that cost of gas will be publicly known as soon as we have executed an agreement and filed it with the Regulatory Commission.
I'm going to ask for about the fifth time. What's the number? Give me a rough number.
Senator Bilikowski, I can't give you that number. It's subject to a confidential negotiation.
You have no idea what it is. Can you give me a range?
Senator Bilikowski, I think the range that I can give you is in if you look at where's the cost of gas coming out of the Cook Inlet, where's the cost of LNG prices now, it's, you know, call those numbers the mid-teens. That's your range.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Klayman, did you have a question?
I do have a question in two areas. Mr. Prestige, I want to go back. There was a question asked about the debt-to-equity ratio, and there was a description was 70-30 was a debt-equity ratio, and your answer was that's within 5-10%. And so I just want to explore that debt-equity ratio. On the simple math on 5-10% would be just change the number by 10% on either, and that would give us a debt equity ratio not of 70-30, but on one side 60-40, 60% debt, 40% equity. Another number, if you did that, 80-20. If I take 10% of 70%, then I'd be doing 7% adjustments, and I'd be 77% debt, 23% equity, or 63% debt, 37% equity. Using the high end of your 5-10% accuracy number. But let's just make it simply the straight 10, the 60-40 or 80-20 debt equity. My read on that is if you shift from a 70-30 to an 80-20, the entire package of this project changes dramatically. And so saying, oh yeah, it's within 5-10% is all over the map. And I'm just wondering, if we're at an 80-20 debt equity, does the project even remotely have a chance of going forward? Now you've got much higher debt costs at 80% and much less equity at 80-20, is it even within the realm of going forward?
Senator Clayman, my response to that is, my response to that question was that I think 70-30 is a good representative indication of where you would typically expect to finance a project like this. There's some variations to what the market will tolerate. It goes into how the project is structured, and it's highly, highly negotiated. And Glenfarne is negotiating that with financial sources right now, and so I really can't speak to where we expected to have that number, because I can't commit to it. We're still negotiating. I don't know exactly what it will be.
Senator Clayman, follow up.
But if we're talking, if that 70-30 is within 5 to 10% of reality, I'm interested in what, let's say you're not at 70-30. What is 80-20 debt equity versus or 60-40 debt equity do in terms of how Glenfarne looks at the project? I know you can't disclose any specific numbers, but let's say those numbers are hugely different on your debt equity from 70-30, and it's your words that gave me the 5 to 10% play in those numbers. So I'm trying to get an understanding of what those mean to you as the representative Glenfarne.
Senator Clayman, as a project developer on a particularly challenging project, we've got to be prepared for a range of different outcomes. We've got to identify, if certain numbers move certain ways, we need to make adjustments other places. And so that's just part of the task of the developer. I'm sorry, I can't give you a more specific answer right now.
Follow-up, Senator Clayman?
Harry, you had some discussion, talk about the state's option to be able to invest, that we'll have equity options, and when we have our exercise for the debt, for the equity options, then we're going to learn a whole lot more than we know today, because then we'll be looking at it as an investor. And I'm looking at the different components just under the estimate that I think Mr. Richards provided of 10 to 11 billion for the treatment plant, 16 billion for the gas line, 20 billion for the LNG plant, totaling around 46.2 billion. Let's just say the state is going to be choosing to exercise its right to invest in the project. What do you see as a minimum amount for the state to meaningfully be able to invest to take advantage of its option to have equity? I mean, is that $100,000, or are we really talking the state needs to be able to invest $1 billion to be a meaningful investor and have a point to play in the project?
Sure, sure. So I'll use the numbers that they were described here. Let's say the gas treatment facility, let's call that $10 billion. If that's financed on a 70-30 debt to equity, $7 billion of that would be funded via project finance debt, and that would leave $3 billion for equity. The state's equity option is to invest between 5 and 25% in equity, and so you'd be looking at on this example that we're using right now, between 5 and 25% of $3 billion.
So that'd be $750 million to get to the 5%, if I'm doing my math right, and I may be getting it wrong.
Give me a second.
Maybe I'm doing that at 25%. Yeah, that's about it. Yeah. That's 25% of $750 million.
Right.
And does,
follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does Glenfarne offer any suggestions on how the states in our tight budget days come up with $750 million that we would need if we want to have that play at 25%?
Unfortunately, Senator, it's a bit outside of our expertise to give advice on that. However, I recognize that there are certain things that are available. Before I get to that, I'd say we're generally supportive of however the state chooses to do that, whether it's through existing funds, existing investment funds, participation by municipalities, or the issuance of bonds to fund that portion.
Thank you.
Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I've got a question for Mr. Richards. So, Mr. Richards, in the latest version of the bill that got released yesterday, we removed some of the pieces about non-disclosure agreements with legislators and the like, but there are some new restrictions on who AGDC may enter into non-disclosure agreements with and what information may or may not be covered on them. They're in Section 14 of the bill. I'm curious if you have had a chance to examine those and what your response is and if any of those might put AGDC at a competitive disadvantage anywhere.
Mr. Richards?
Madam Chair, Senator Myers, through the chair, again, yes, you're referring to Section 14, which is on the confidentiality provisions. And from my read of this, it essentially will limit AGDC's ability to enter into likely confidentiality agreements because when the would-be counterparties look at AGDC and the opportunity then for the information that is AGDC is going to be held in confidence maybe then shared with the legislators, I think it would be an extremely challenging position to put AGDC in the business case. And that's when we go back to the original intent of AGDC by the legislature was that we would act in the best interest of the state and are given the responsibility to hold information confidential. And I will tell you that what we have done during our existence is as we have discussions with interested parties, whether they be had prior investors, whether they be partners with the project, whether they be off-takers of the project, it was that we would sign confidentiality agreements right at the outset of our discussions. And that was key to the business practices that those entities are used to and allow them to have an open and free discussion with AGDC without the consideration that information that AGDC would be holding would then not be shared with anybody else without consent by both parties. So it, from my estimation, it would impose, again, extreme challenges for us to act in the best interest of the state because likely the opportunities that we hope to be able to have discussions with may not become available to us just because of this provision.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. That 15-year-old law was for a different project with three producers and the state. And those three producers were exceedingly transparent. Multiple meetings, no question answering disclosure related to costs. So we are in a very different scenario right now. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Richards and Mr. Prestige, yesterday the White House issued a statement in support of SB 280. I think based on the timing, it's clear that he was voicing support for the committee substitute. But regardless, more seriously, we also had an invocation of the Defense Production Act. And we've heard people hear testimony trying to puzzle out what that meant. And so has the White House communicated to you how they intend to use the Defense Production Act to support the project? Are we talking about offtake agreements? Are we talking about equity investment? They have about between $1 and $2 billion in that fund. Are they talking about getting additional funds? What has the White House communicated to you about how they're actually going to use the Defense Production Act to help the project?
Senator Dunbar, the White House hasn't communicated any intent on how they would do that to us.
Mr. Richards, can you describe to us how the Defense Production Act could be used to assist this project from your view?
Mr. Richards?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, again, we've not had that conversation directly with the White House either. When you look at the Defense Production Act, as you heard from the consultant that presented to the committee last week, that again, there are provisions that was Defense Production Act was set up for. The latitude that the administration has now in executing their take on the Defense Production Act is yet to be known to us. Well, ideally, though, one of the key issues of this project moving forward is around energy security, and not only for the citizens of the state of Alaska, but also for our military bases. And so that is key that, as you heard from Mr. Begich, if we are beholden to importation of LNG as the alternative because the project does not move forward, then we would be in a position of relying on foreign sources of energy, not only for our in-state needs, but also for our military bases. And that's probably untenable for those military bases because, again, any blockade of shipments to Alaska would put those military bases in jeopardy. So, ideally, if the Department of Defense has an opportunity to be able to help in underpinning this project, that would be helpful. But yet, it is yet to be determined how that will be achieved.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunbar. Mr. Begich is actually affiliated with the governor's office. I wonder if he might have more information with that direct communication between the governor and the president. Mr. Begich, any comments on the Defense Production Act and how it might be implemented here?
Madam Chair, thank you. And Senator Dunbar, thank you for the question. And I'm not privy to the personal conversation that governor may have had with the president or anyone related to, but I can tell you the general sense of it as my experience in the federal government. This item and my advice to the governor on this has been that this Defense Act has an impact if they utilize it. It helps move the bureaucracy of the federal government, for example, on financing or things of that nature that may be necessary. If they believe they need to make an economic investment to help a project move forward, that's always in the realm. But it opens up the door for the president to unilaterally make decisions without Congress's input, just doing it on behalf of the country if it has a need or a purpose, in this case, as he has declared, that this has a national interest, this natural gas line. So there's a lot of tools in the box. It's a question of how they use it, but it also highlights the importance of the project among the federal agencies. So it does help in any processes we need within the bureaucracy, but it could open up other doors of impact and financial impact.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll just say first, I would welcome an investment by the federal government in this project. I think that would be great. And second, if, as Mr. Richards stated, this is about getting gas to our military bases, then that is further evidence that the president supports the committee substitute because it includes a spur line to Fairbanks and Eielson and Wainwright, and the original version doesn't. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I've got a question for Mr. Prestige. You talked about not wanting to release the cost estimates because of the competitive pressure that puts on the price that you're selling the gas for to the end consumer, primarily the East Asian consumer. If you did release those cost estimates and then incurred that pressure, would that then put pressure on you to attempt to buy the gas from the producers on the North Slope at a lower cost, which would then impact our production taxes and royalties?
Senator Myers, that's one potential outcome. If any time you push down the price of the project, you're going to have to find ways of trying to make that up anywhere else in the project, and eventually just gets to the point where it's not economical to build the project. So that's ultimately, the worst case outcome that we're trying to avoid.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? All right.
Senator Giesel, if I may.
Mr. Prestige, I'm not seeing any more questions from the committee, and I wondered if you wanted to offer a wrap-up, closing comments on what you like or don't like about the bill, which is actually the subject today.
Certainly. If I may, there's two points that we haven't really touched on that I thought might be helpful to give some feedback on. One is a requirement for legislative approval of foreign ownership and investment relationships. Comments on that are that, first of all, kind of negative or bad actor type foreign participation in the project is prevented by a number of federal laws. You have OFAC laws, you have CFIUS laws that prevent that type of unwanted participation in a U.S. project. We view the idea of having legislative approval over any type of foreign financial relationship as a very difficult, a very burdensome administrative hurdle to add. Much of the project finance community, much of the project finance that would participate in a project like this is international, whether based out of Canada, banks and equity investors in Europe or Asia. We would look at it as a significant hindrance to have to seek legislative approval for participation by very ordinary course financing sources for a project like this. Additionally, I just want to suggest that when it comes to disclosures of different transaction participations in the project, considering that it is permitted by the Department of Energy and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, does have numerous disclosure obligations. And so I'd suggest, and if you allow, I'll spend some time perhaps making more specific suggestions, that there are instances where disclosures are required to the Department of Energy, such as when we enter into an LNG offtake agreement, when there's a change of control of ownership, that triggers disclosure obligations that might be considerable as a proposal that could work within some of this framework.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that input. Any other closing remarks that you might want to add?
Not at this time, Senator. I think we've made our point. That appreciate the efforts by the committee. Want to reiterate our objective as a private company participating in this project remains to be delivering gas to Alaskans and seeing this project actually go forward. So that's our goal here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And so that actually will conclude our meeting today on this bill, which is called the Supporting a Gas Line for Alaskans Act. So I think we're both on the same page there. Our next meeting will be tomorrow afternoon at 3:30, and we're going to take a break from the Supporting a Gas Line for Alaskans Act because we do have some other work to get done. We have three House bills that will be up. House Joint Resolution 44, Supporting Native Corporation Business Development Program. House Bill 93, Residential Requirements, Hunting, Trapping, Fishing. And House Bill 79, Naming Vic Fisher, Shoup Bay Marine Park. So at this time, we will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 10:42 p.m.